It's a very nice opportunity to bring all these different disciplines together and see what we can do together. So a very short background about myself. I'm from the Netherlands, Utrecht University. I'm an assistant professor. At one point I was in computer science. I still am, but I try to do crossovers to other disciplines as well. My main topic is in social signal processing, which is the machine understanding of human social behavior. I mainly work on looking at videos and trying to understand what's going on in these videos in terms of the behavior of people, and especially the interaction of people. And I apply that work in different niches, basically. So I look at interactive playgrounds, and I look at lie detection from the body. And both of these are also reflected in the talk. And also look a little bit at real-time interactions with avatars, virtual humans. But I will not be talking about it today. So if you have any questions about it, I will be around for the full 2 days. Okay, so this is basically the brief outline of the talk. I'm not in anyone's view, am I? But a little bit. Okay, so basically it's about quantitative and qualitative representations of body. Body pulse, body movement. And through three use cases, I try to eventually link the quantitative and the qualitative aspects. This one is a little bit different from what I would normally do. Usually I would pick one of those use cases and would explain it for, well, an hour or so. And then eventually I will end up and saying, hey, this was a very successful piece of research. Now I've taken one step back, and I'm not talking about any of the successes that we've had, but mainly about the limitations. So it's more process thing and the lessons we have learned along the way. So I think that's more informative, and eventually it allows us to see how quantitative and qualitative can come together nicely. Okay, so very briefly about qualitative and quantitative representations. Qualitative for me will be typically a textual representation in terms of categories, in terms of labels. So it could be about the position somewhere in space, pose, the shape that you're assuming, but also about the movement. So there's many ways to describe these. Typically the work by von Laban, but also the more recent body and action posture system. These are common languages basically to describe human motion, even a little bit human interaction. So probably most of you will be familiar with at least one of those, probably have worked with those. So we can characterize this qualitative representation by manual annotation. Typically we look at movement, we look at people interacting via dance, gesturing, and we would have to manually describe this. So this is something that you might have done before, seen before. And this manual annotation means that it's perceptual. I'm looking at something, and the way I interpret the movement, that's what I will write down. If two people will do the same thing, they might not agree on it. So it's subjective. And the good thing is that intentions of movement, intentions of interactions can be reproduced quite well. So if I'm pointing at something, I could just write down point. If I'm grabbing or reaching, I'll write that down. So even though the movements or the postures might be very similar, I'll write it down, and probably that is very meaningful representation of what's going on. The drawbacks are that it's quite time consuming. You have to manually annotate all the aspects that are relevant to the movements. So that takes a lot of time, and also more subtle aspects can get ignored. So the magnitude of the movement, or maybe the precise direction or the speed, they're only very coarsely coded, if they're coded at all. So there's typically a trade-off between the level of detail, level of granularity in which you code, and the time that you will have to spend coding it. Okay, completely at the other side we have quantitative representations. So these are quantitative units. And they describe the position, again, in space. They can describe the pulse either as positions of key points in the body, so as the joints, or we can describe these as joint angles. And we also can describe movements. Typically, we describe the movement also in quantitative units, typically measured in meters per second. So there's typically a lot of ways to describe movement and body position quantitatively. A lot of work has been done with people working on 3D character animation, but also in motion capture. And there's a couple of standards that are available that are being adopted, especially by researchers. So if you look at the characteristics of quantitative motion, these are basically the opposite than you would have for qualitative motion representations. So we can measure movement qualitatively using motion capture or vision-based, so using cameras. And the measurements that we get, they're objective. So there's no debate about whether an arm was here or here. We measure it, and that's it. The drawback of that is that there is no interpretation of the movement. So we're just describing how it looks, but we're not saying what a person is doing or how a person, what kind of feeling is conveyed. So a lot of information is missing there. And typically, that's the type of information that we're interested in, that we want to convey to an audience, for example. So if you would look at the qualitative and the quantitative aspects, then these are quite complementary, right? So one, time-consuming to annotate conveys the information that we want. The other, we can measure automatically, but then it's missing the more interpretation. So seems wise to combine the two. So first, a little bit about automated measurement of body pose, because most of the examples that I will give typically have some aspect of this inside them. So there's two ways broadly to do this, and the first one is using motion capture. So people will be wearing a suit with markers, and you would have cameras all around that track these markers, and eventually will be able to piece back exactly positions in space. So that requires an actor to wear a suit. So every time you want to record something, someone needs to put in on a suit and needs to be in this specially equipped space. So that's also quite expensive. The alternative is to use cameras. There are now depth cameras such as Kinect on the market that can do it better, more robustly, but still there is a little bit of lacking robustness. You can only see of analyze what the camera sees well. So if there's tiny little movements, typically these go unnoticed. Also, if you're facing away from the camera, you can't really be seen. But the good thing about this method is it's completely unobtrusive. So you don't have to wear anything. You don't have to have markers. So that's good. We can actually record people without anything they have to do especially. When we talk about the analysis of body motion, we have different levels of analysis, different levels of detail, granularity. So at the most rigid level, we have the body as a whole. So we could say something about the position in space. If we look at interaction, we can say that people are moving closer together or that they're just circling. It's one very crude way of describing people's motion, people's behavior. Slightly more detail is using limb information, so saying something about a whole arm, leg, head. And if we go even further, we can say something about the joints or just really the sub-body parts. And again, even go down to parts of the fingers, for example. And the analysis can be in 2D or 3D. So in the examples that I will give, I will explain which of the levels is important and whether we analyze it in 2D or 3D. Okay, so now we'll start explaining the three use cases that I will be discussing. And they all have different technology. So you will see that some use motion capture, some use video, some use depth cameras. And there's also different levels of analysis. So sometimes we look at just the body parts, just the body in space. Sometimes we look at the body parts. And more importantly, we have different ways of modeling the interactions. So there's different ways that we describe what's going on because of the application demands different types of modeling. So very briefly, this is mainly for the slides. This will become apparent from what will follow next. Okay, if there's any questions so far, then just let me know. I think this workshop show it could be a little bit interactive if it requires to do so. Okay, so the first use case is about lie detection. This might seem a little bit of an odd topic, but actually it fits quite well in what we want to discuss these days. Everyone lies. There was a study, it's always a bold statement. It was a study by Feldman who analyzed 10-minute conversations in social settings, so talking with friends, talking with colleagues, with family, and he found that people on average would tell 3 lies in those 10 minutes. And no less than 60% of all the people actually were engaged in lying. So there were people that would lie a lot. Would be 40% of the people who wouldn't lie at all. But it's not that uncommon to lie. But most of these lies are white lies, such as, oh, you look nice today, or I've been thinking about you a lot. There's no harm in those, and actually, these are more the social glue that we sometimes need to feel better or to have a better relation with other people. Lies can also have more negative consequences. So for example, if we have police interviews, if we're interrogating a subject, or maybe even a witness, lies can have the effect that the facts are not apparent, and so actually the consequences can be quite bad. So in this use case, what we will do is we look at interactions between an interviewer, so let's say a policeman, and an interviewee, which could be a subject, for example, who did or did not do something. In lie detection, we're typically interested in finding out whether someone did it just by looking at the behavior of the other person. That's what we will be doing in this use case. So we believe that we can say that someone's lying or not just by looking at a person. Just looking at behavior, and the behavior can manifest itself in many modalities. So we can look at the voice, for example. If people get a more squeaky voice, then we believe that a person can be lying. Also, if it's more stressful, we know that a person might be lying or at least is experiencing stress. We can also measure this in physiological cues. We can look at the heart rate. We expect that the heart rate goes up, skin conductance also increases. If we look at brain activity, we see that certain areas of the brain get activated when people have to tell a lie, partly because it's emotionally involved, partly because it's cognitively more demanding. But we can also look at the face and the body, so nonverbal behavior. And we believe that there's a lot of cues that can give away whether someone's lying or not. A lot of research has been done into that. Well, first, people are very bad at detecting liars. On average, people score 54%, which is slightly above guessing. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But first, if we train people, if we tell them what to look for, then it does not increase detection rates. So if we have courses for police people, for interrogators, they typically do not score above the 54%. And the thing is, their confidence is boosted because they follow the training. So basically what we do is we have people that are as bad as they were before, but now they don't know it anymore because they think they are right. So that's actually a bad thing. So ideally, we would not want to rely on people doing this kind of job. And one of the reasons is that we as humans, we have wrong beliefs about how humans communicate. So we have wrong beliefs about what people do when they lie. So even though we do it, we don't know how we do it, how that would look like. So that's one of the main things. So then people started to look at more objective or even automatic ways of detecting liars. So this is a study by De Paolo, who looked at hundreds of studies and looked at the different types of behavior to see which ones are now connected to lying and not to telling the truth. And the bad thing is there are many cues, but none of them is really good. And there are several reasons for that. So the first one is that there's a lack of cues that only occur when lying. So many people believe that if you would not face someone straight on, so you would look away, that is a cue that someone is lying. But the fact is that we do this all the time, so it's also a cue that someone is telling the truth. So even though the behavior might go a lot with lying, it also goes with telling the truth. There's contradictory findings between studies.
So some studies find, for example, that people look away when they're lying. Others find that people continuously look at the people because they want to know if the other believes their lies. So these are contradictory findings. And the third is that if there is a cue that works well, it doesn't explain a lot. So maybe 1 or 2% of out of all the people will do it consistently and others won't. So the effect sizes of these cues are very small. So that's not a very hopeful message. So hundreds of cues, none really works. Does that mean that we should just give up? We thought we shouldn't. So we looked at what has been done, what has not been done, and might there be something that we can do to have a better analysis and still find something that's worth pursuing. So there's two characteristics of the studies that have been done so far. And the first one is that most of the study have used manually coded behaviors. So these were cores, as I explained before. So we thought, what would happen if we would measure behavior more accurately, really down to the millimeter? Would that actually help being able to tell differences between liars and truth tellers? And in this case, we focus on the body. So we look at body behavior, not facial expressions, not focal, just on the body. The second is, people have been looking at a single person. So remember, there's an interview, there's an interviewee, there's an interviewer. People have only been looking at the interviewee, just looking if that person shows certain behavior that might tell them apart. So what if we analyze not only the interviewee, but also the interviewer? What if we take them together because they are interacting with each other? And the measure that we looked at is nonverbal mimicry. So I'll come to that later. Okay, so there's good reasons just to look at bodily cues. So the first one is that we're not distracted by someone's physical appearance or identity. So if I would ask you for these two people, who's the villain and who's probably telling the truth, well, just by looking at them, you will be sure that Mother Teresa probably never told a lie. Or maybe she said, oh, you look good today. But not a real lie, whereas we know that the gentleman on the left, typically, in trying to take over the world, will have told many lies to everyone. So the body, if we analyze, especially with the techniques that we do, we're not distracted by the identity of the person. Also, we're not trained to control our bodies. So we are very much trained to control our face if we're talking to other people. We know how to keep our face straight, but we're not trained to do this with the body. So if we're just talking with people, no one has been taught to just stand in a certain way. You might do it, but there is a lot more automated behavior going on. So nonverbal mimicry, that's the measure that we want to look at. It's a tendency to copy behavior of others, and it manifests itself in many different ways. So it manifests itself in the body posture, in the movement, in the facial expression, but even vocal aspects are just copied as well. So it's interesting to see that it happens on a lot of levels. And if you really look at how people interact, you actually see this going on. So why is it that we look at mimicry? Well, the first, if we have an interviewer and an interviewee, their behavior is coordinated. So one would ask a question, the other would answer it. One would do something, the other would respond to it. But also the mood of an interrogation is reflected in both. It's not that one is very cheerful and the other one is very angry. No, so the two of them move and behave in unison. And another thing is that mimicry increases when you are cognitively loaded. So that means if you are more busy processing, more busy thinking about whatever it is, you are more likely to copy the behavior of others. And since lying probably is going to induce your cognitive load, because instead of just telling what you did yesterday, you have to make up a story and stick to that story despite you know what you really did yesterday, it will involve more cognitive processing and probably might also increase the levels of mimicry. Okay, so to the study that we did, This looks very artificial, and it was. But this was how we addressed this. So we would have two people sitting opposite each other. One of them would be the policeman. The other will be the subject. Most of them were students, psychology students, computer science students. And as you can see, they're wearing these straps. In those straps, there are little boxes, and these are inertial sensors. So typically, they measure everything about the movement. And the good thing about it is that even though we had a camera from the side, we could also measure, for example, the movement of the legs and basically all the small movements that you would not be able to see due to the table or due to them being in front of each other. And this is how that would look like. I hope this one plays. It does. So this will be a very angry maybe I should have copied it. Okay, this is a little bit sad. Just wait. Okay, so this is basically the bad cop and a subject that's not really impressed. Okay, this is what we just recorded for fun, but at least this shows quite well the type of information that we have. So even though we're not looking at identities, you might probably be saying something about what type of people we're looking at, but we don't know for sure, right? So the only thing that we can go on is the behavior displayed in the video. Okay. You can also see that it's very accurate the recording of this, even though these are straps. Okay, in calculating mimicry, what we have been doing is first we had basically two people that we recorded. And if you want to look at mimicry, what you need to do is correlate the behavior of one, the posture of one, with the posture of the other. So we normalize it for the length of the person and also for other measures. And then we aligned them basically to sit on the same chair, and then we rotated one person 180 degrees to make sure that they were not facing each other, that they were really on the same seat. So this is what that looked like. So these are two people sitting opposite each other. And what we did then was we took the difference between all the pairs of joints. So these are the white lines here. And we sum those. So the more the poses will be apart, the larger that sum will be. So if I would just extend my arm and the other person wouldn't, then there would obviously be a lot of difference between the joints of that arm. And that will be our only quantitative measure of interaction. So it would, from this whole interaction, we would just boil it down into a single variable. Yes?
Sorry, just wanted to clarify. So the differences are, I'm looking at that last drawing, the differences are distances between joints?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
How about if I would do something with this arm and the other guy would do with this arm?
Exactly. Yeah, so that would be a problem. And I said here, rotated 180 degrees, I meant the mirrored. See, that's a mistake. So it's not very clear how to calculate mimicry. So there's a lot of different things that you might want to take into account or might not want to take into account. So for example, if you're sitting opposite each other and one person just leans to the right, should the other person lean to his right or lean to the left? So what does that mean? So there's a lot of choices that you can make in that. Moreover, there is something that we absolutely did not take into account, and that is that typically if you do mimicry, you're also copying the function of the behavior, not per se the exact behavior itself. So for example, if you would be in a conversation and one person would just set to the side, the other person might just hang in front or might join or might just hang back, just as a relaxing thing. So just the function of the behavior, relaxing or being annoyed, would be copied. So, and it could look different. In this case, we chose to look just at the shape of the body. Just look at the shape, not the function, the form, not the function.
You did not separate between visible and invisible because they're sitting across the table, so they're not seeing each other's.
Yeah, so eventually, so this is just a very, very high level discussion of the research. We have been looking at all the different limbs. Most of the effects that we found are copied. So what happens for your left leg also happens for your whole body. So I've been looking at that. And typically, this generally holds. So it's funny to see that people also copy the behavior that they can't see. So that's fine. There's some more thoughts about it. So, and that should look a little bit like this. I hope this one plays. Yes. So you see here in this very crude plot, the two people sitting opposite each other. This is not acted, this is actual footage. And below you see the level of mimicry. And typically the lower it is, the more mimicry it is. So you could see that one person would move his hand quite a lot here. I can play this again, I guess. Around here. And the other didn't. And you can see that this actually goes up. So that means that the mimicry actually is lower. Right? Okay, in the study we had 43 participants. They were interviewed on three topics. And one was just a truth, so they would just be talking about what they had been doing that day. It was just a very informal talk. The second one that all the participants did was is an easy line, so there was a puzzle solving, and they just had to change one detail about the puzzle. So it was not a big thing. But then there was a difficult line, so there was the game of Cluedo that they did not play. But still they had to explain something about the game, so how it went and who won. And the very difficult line was exactly the same as the game of Cluedo, but then explained backwards. So instead of saying, first I did this and then I did that, they had to explain it backwards, saying it ended like this and then this happened before. So that's even more difficult. If you make up a story in your head, especially with a lie, it's chronological, right? So you think, I'm gonna do this, and then I did that. If you have to talk it backwards, then you really have to dig deep inside you to find what you actually did. So what we did was we analyzed the amount of mimicry between the two. So we had 43 people and we had just one measure of their interaction. Yes?
Did you have a cognitive load condition?
Yes. So we asked people, so this is one of the slides I actually deleted because we're already talking. So we asked people, did you think of the difficulty? And actually they matched with what we expected. So quantitative was slightly different. So they were rating this on a Likert scale. After each interview, they would say, how difficult did you think this interview was? And then typically people found the easy lie easier than the truth even, which is funny. And the difficult lie they found more difficult, and the very difficult lie they found even more difficult than that. Was that?
It was actually a slightly different question. So I wondered if you separated lies from cognitive load. So I was wondering if you had a condition where you had increased cognitive load that wasn't about lying.
Yeah. No, we didn't do that. So we didn't experimentally distinguish them, but we did validate the level of difficulty that they experienced. So that was self-reported. Okay, so this is one slide of results. Basically, this is the amount of mimicry. You can see these are negative numbers. So you can see that the more mimicry, the higher the bar in this case. And you can see that the easy lie, actually people have more, found more easier, had less difficulty with, and also showed less mimicry. It was typically because they would actually anticipate that they would be asked about the one little thing they had to lie about. And you can see the mimicry really increases with the amount of difficulty of the lie, basically. So we also set apart the truth from lying, and we could actually distinguish groups between that. And that's another study altogether. So what we have learned, so that there's lots of other things that I can tell you about this study and follow-up studies. But this is basically the point that I just want to say, okay, until here, and see what we have learned basically from this analysis. So, 20 minutes. Okay. Nonverbal mimicry is a good cue. We can use it to measure interactions. We can do that automatically, and also mimicry increases with difficulty. But there's a very big limitation. That is that a single measure lacks the analysis of function. So there's a lot of different things going on. Turn-taking, for example. One person asks a question, better response. I'm pointing at someone, you're also pointing. I'm looking at something, I'm making notes, the other is not making notes. So there are a lot of different behaviors that we cannot distinguish between. So they're all combined into this one single measure. So what have we learned? We need more variables to describe interactions. Okay, since I only have 20 minutes, I'm going to rush a little bit through it. Second use case is the interactive playground, which is basically one of my pet projects. It's a combination between traditional playground games, so playing outside, which is both social, you play with your friends, and it's active. You will be running around, playing all kinds of different games, rope skipping. But also, it's not adjusted to skill. So this is rope skipping. I was never allowed to participate because I was too bad. So, and also, if it would be raining, no one would go outside to play soccer or play tag. So they're fun. They have good aspects, but it doesn't work in every situation. Contrasting, we have digital games, which are individual. So they lack the social aspects, and they're very not active. So we have this couch potato thing, people just sitting at home, eating chips, and not playing with friends and not moving at all. But they are tailored to skill. You can typically select the level of difficulty, you can choose the games that you want to play, and you can play them whatever way you want, adjusted to how good you are and what you actually value. And they're engaging. I mean, there's sounds, there's a storyline, there's all kinds of appraisal techniques, so people really like the digital games. So our idea was, why not combine digital games and traditional playground games? See if we can just get the benefit of both. So you play digital games, but you keep people physically active. Or the other way around, you play traditional games, so playground games, but you make them interactive. So I'll be discussing the second, and I'll work on the interactive playground. So most of this is by my PhD student, Alejandro Moreno. So this is very briefly what the interactive playground looks like. So you can see this is a space, it's approximately 6 by 6 meters. And you can see children running around and have circles projected around them. So they're playing the game of tag. I just looked it up, I think in French it's jeu de chat. Is that official term? Okay. So you have two roles. You have, I think, the chat, that will be called. He has to tag one of the runners. The runners have to run away from the chat. So that's it. So here we have different circles projected around everyone. And the blue circle is for the runner, and the orange circle is for the chat. And instead of physically tagging someone, what they had to do is make the circles collide. So if you would have your orange circle collide with a blue circle, that would count as a tag. And what we used as technology is we had four connects in the ceiling that would just track all the players. Okay, can show you a video from that. I hope this is clear. So left, you can see basically what the connects see. They're stitched together and not too well. And here you can see the position of the players. In red is the tagger. I see sometimes there's big leaves again because of the stitching. So this video was made not officially, but was made just to demonstrate what is going on. So yeah, basically what you can see is that the blue lines run away from the red line. Exactly what you would expect. Okay, so the good thing is that we have these trackers. So we have tracks. We have 2D positions of all the players over time. And we can analyze what's going on in such a playground. So what we can do is ask ourselves questions. How do children play? What is the effect of changes in the playground? So what happens if we have obstacles? What is it if we make it bigger or smaller? But we can also have more interesting questions, such as, are personality and interactions correlated? So do shy children play differently than dominant children, for example? So we can ask ourselves all these kind of questions. We can analyze it offline. We can also do this online. So since we have a tracker that already projects these circles, we can online try to see if we can do something with that information. So we can monitor the amount of physical exertion. So we can see if children are running around. If they're running around too much, we might just have a break. If they're not moving around at all, we might try to motivate them to move around. We can also identify children that are not engaged. So if three children are playing and one is just in the corner by himself, then we can actually detect that and maybe do something about it. And we can also try to steer the play. So we can see if we can have different types of behaviors just by adjusting elements of this playground. Here I want to talk about analyzing roles of players. So seeing if we can find out if someone is a tagger or a runner. So what we're doing is we look at interaction between pairs of children. So not all children together, we look first at pairs of children. So what we do is we have three variables. We have approach, chase, and avoid. These are three behaviors that are quite common in analyzing tag. You would expect that a tagger would approach or chase another person, and that a runner would avoid the tagger. So there's two measures that we use. The first one is the relative movement direction. So if there's two people, am I running away from you, or am I running exactly in the same direction as you are? I'm not going into details because I think that we don't have the time. But if we would look at how that would play out, then typically zero means I'm going towards you. So what you will see is that taggers go towards the runners. But then again, runners try to go away from the taggers. So they're typically having this 90 or even more degrees difference. We can do the same for the amount of movement, so we can differentiate between standing and running. We can also do this probabilistically. And eventually what we do is we look at approaching, chasing, and avoiding by looking at very simple rules. So for example, if we would do a chase, then what we would say is that person one has the same direction as person two, so we're moving in this direction, and we're both running. So to us, that means chasing. Avoiding will be that one person is running away from the other, whereas the other is walking towards you. Right? So I'm going away, you're walking towards me. And both of us are running. And for approach, we can do a similar kind of thing. So what we have here is a quantitative analysis of the interactions, and we use here three variables. So in the first study, lie detection, we had one, now we have three to really say something about the interaction between children. And what we said for the role recognition that you're a tagger if you are approaching or chasing others, and otherwise you're running. So with this very simple rule, we had an overall accuracy for the roles of 72%, which is very low. So we managed to get higher numbers later, but for this one, what we analyzed is that there is quite a lot of difficulty with the moment directly after the tag, because it's not well defined. So I'm tagging you, that means that you have to chase other people, and I become a runner, so I have to run away from you. So this behavior that's not well defined in our rules we could not find those moments back in the videos. Runners chase other runners. You see that a lot. So if I'm chasing you, but there's actually two people, then those two people apparently chase each other. So that makes it difficult. And there's all other ways to avoid taggers. So instead of just running away, you can also duck or just point at other people or do all kinds of strange movements. We did not code any of that, and we did not take it into account in our analysis. So in conclusion, we can automatically track children in the playground. We can actually analyze their interactions from these tracks. But if we look at role recognition, then still our units are not good enough. So with our three units instead of one, we still could not take into account all the complexities of the behavior that we would see on the playground. Okay. Final use case, detection of social encounters from video in this case. So we're looking at social behavior, especially interactions from video, because we want to know something about the relation of the people. And also we want to know something about the settings. So if we would look at a random YouTube clip, if we look at the interactions, we would be able to say something about what kind of setting the clip was shot in. So if we know this, then we can do more social analysis. So for example, if we would look at elderly homes, we would know if a person will be talking to a caregiver, to a family member, maybe to another patient. We can just search in YouTube, search in video archives, and we can facilitate humanities research. We can see how interactions change over time. We can search for specific interactions and see how they change over time. But if we're looking at video, then there's a couple of challenges. So mocap, it was perfect. We had all the nice data when tracking from the ceiling and looking only at body position. That's also quite doable. Here we really want to look at detailed, subtle interactions. So that means that we need to have pulse information, but we need to get it from the video. So what you will see is that since people vary a lot in how they look and how they behave, and also how things are shot, we are having difficulties with robustly figuring out how people are depicted. And moreover, if we look at interactions and if we look at behavior, then there's two things that are very challenging. So the first is that there is very large intra-class variation. That means that if you have one type of interaction, such as a greeting or just giving a handshake, then there is quite a lot of variation in the behavior. So we had, for example, people do hugging, which is quite uncomfortable for Dutch computer science students. So we had a whole variety of people hugging, from hugging like this to bro hugging to just bumping. We had a whole variation, and everyone considered that hugging, but you would say, okay, this is an awkward hug, this is a very passionate hug. How is that? So there's a lot of difference between a class. But another thing is there can be very subtle differences between other classes. So in this picture, you can see two people involved in a handshake, but two other people involved in passing an object that looks almost exactly the same. Okay, so what we're doing here is we're looking at social interactions between pairs of people, really greetings. I'm gonna speed a little bit up. So we're using machine learning techniques, but it's really about the units that we're taking into account. So what we do is, first we look at the pulse of the people. And if you look at these two images, you could probably say something about the models of the interactions that they're describing. So walk you through it. So these are two people. Person one with a hat here. Again, two people. You can see their bodies here. And this is basically the interaction that they're involved in. And this is just the pulse information. So it says something about how their arms are positioned in space. This is a handshake, which you can see because their hands are slightly lower. It's like here. And this here is a fist bump. It's people doing this. So typically you do that slightly higher. So you can tell that a little bit from this type of pulse information that we're using in our detections. Another component is we're using motion. And you can see that we focus on the motion of the right hand, and we use optical flow for that. And we show that in these types of diagrams. So combined, this is what it gives. So left is a handshake, which you can see is with those arrows, they're going up and down here, up and down. So you can see people basically doing this. And this is, again, fist bump, which you can see is that first it's going towards each other and then it's going away. It's like, boom, like that. So again, we had a lot of variation in people performing this interaction. So these are basically the units. So we have those different aspects. So we have how the head looks, how the torso looks, how the arm looks, and also how the motion of the right hand looks. So these are units. So each can be considered an interaction unit. So this is how we found those models. So we're looking basically at one pulse that we call the epitome that we think is most characteristic in an interaction. So typically for us, that will be the moment of first contact. So after that, you would have this very characteristic shake of the arms. So what we did is, in typical machine learning approach, we had a set of videos, we coded them, and then what we did was we found the parameters of all the different elements in our model. So it would be the pulse models, so the one with the small lines, the motion models, so the one with the arrows, and we would also have the relative position of the bars and detection thresholds for the detection. And what we would do if we want to detect a certain interaction in video, we would have this model slide it through the video, and if we would have a hit, so that means if the model would respond well to the video, then we would just try to see if in frames backwards and forwards, we would see similar motion. And if we would have that, then typically you would see that found here a handshake, we would just be able to find it back and forth, and then we would have found a handshake in the video. This is typically a result. So in green is what we detect, in blue is a different annotations from other people. So our results, especially for interactions that look very much alike, they are state of the art. But we had difficulty with interaction that we did not expect. So if you would just run it over YouTube, then we would have a problem because we would find handshakes everywhere because we had no idea what the lack of a handshake would look like. So again, we had units that we could use to find something, but not to eliminate all the different choices that we would have. So we had units learned automatically from video based on pulse and motion. We could use those models and learn them from just a very limited amount of data, but we would have difficulty with all the things that we did not train them on. So what we learned this time is we can learn those units from data, but typically we still don't have enough units. Okay, then I come to combining everything that we have learned so far and seeing what we can do with both the qualitative and the quantitative representation of body motion. So what we have learned is that we can look at behavior at different levels of granularity. We have been looking at the body pulse, we have been looking at position, we have been looking at pulse and motion. And what we want to do exactly depends a little bit on the application. So there's no common representation of interactions. So for every application, you come up with something else, maybe that doesn't work for something else. So we don't have a common repertoire of variables, of units to look at. What we also learned is that a single or a limited number of those variables is typically insufficient. We can just get somewhere, but there's a lot of different things that we can't do. So we cannot fully capture the complexity of behavior that we're looking at. But so far, we have not been looking at any of the qualitative aspects. We only have been looking at quantitative things that we could measure automatically. So what if we will be able to combine the two? And why will we do that? So the main reason is that we can accurately get quantitative representations. We can measure it using mocap or video, and we would have them basically without any time we had to spend on it. But the thing is, we would not have the semantic or the intuitive meaning of what we're recording. And that is something that we would have with a qualitative representation. And also most of the knowledge that we have about how people interact is in terms of qualitative knowledge. So everything that has been found so far about how people communicate in different situations, cultures, we know because people wrote it down in a qualitative way. So it would be great if we could harvest all that knowledge and be able to still use automated measurements to do that. So what I propose is why not measure body motion quantitatively, video, mocap, but then analyze interactions qualitatively. Would that work? So what we would really need is a language, a repertoire of units that would actually be shared between those two. So we would have semantic units of pose and motion of the individual, and semantic units of the interaction, so relative pose and motion, and also the patterns of motion over time. So some of the things might be repetitive, for example. And there's two challenges that we're facing. So the first one is to find a common repertoire of semantic units. So even though there is a lot of different ways to describe body movement, which are the common units that we can actually use throughout a whole lot of applications? And this will be a very big challenge. And the second one is, if we have such a repertoire, can we learn it automatically and in such a way that we can robustly get it from the motion capture or the video? There's no point in having a repertoire that can describe the motion, but that cannot be used to automatically do so. That was the whole point. So what we want to do is identify and select those units from two perspectives. So first, humans, and second one, machines. And that will require an iterative approach. So what we'll have to do is pick a qualitative unit, see if we can find it. If we can find it, see how well it generalizes or how specific it is, and then repeat. So this requires at one point machine learning, the pattern recognition, things that we already do. On the other hand, it means that we have to have perception experiments to see what machines find correlates well with what we as humans would actually think of the same behavior. So concluding, it might be a little bit all of a sudden, but we have to do it anyways. So we can combine qualitative and quantitative, I think. And it will actually give us qualitative information found automatically. What it requires is that we have a common repertoire, something that we do not have at the moment. But it also requires that we have detectors to actually get the information that we want robustly. And this can be achieved if we do this in a very probably large iterative approach. This is not something that we will do overnight. This is something that we have to actually have to shape. And actually, we start working on exactly this topic in 2017. So what I will hope is that from members from all kinds of disciplines, we will be able to just see if we can actually make those challenges work. So that is it. Thank you for attending. And I have to also thank some of the people that actually did quite a lot of the work, actually most of the work that I was actually telling you about. So thank you. And if there's any questions, then I'll be happy to take those.
It's a question of clarification around the measures and the mimicry thing. I didn't pay attention if you mentioned the connection with the synchronization in the timing. Do you consider something as mimicry, even if it's not synchronized?
Yeah.
And if it's not synchronized, to which extent do you consider it as mimicry?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. The question was, if you're looking at mimicry, do you take into account the synchronization in time? So do you consider that maybe one person is copying the person after it happened? So for these numbers, we did not, but later we have been looking at a little bit of correlation. So we use dynamic time warping. So basically what it does is it tries to find the optimal correlation between people. So it could have an offset, for example, of 2 seconds and then to 1 second. So you're a little bit more free in how you match it. And also from the offset, you can analyze what's going on. So you can follow who's copying whom. So that was, that helped a little bit. And typically we found some patterns in that, in the copying behavior. Still, what we found difficult was that sometimes you would take into account patterns that were meaningless. So the dynamic time warping would get stuck if one person made a very rash movement and the other did not copy it. Then it would still try to align those two, even though that movement was completely isolated. So this is typically something that is not well represented in using this single motion. So you want to be able to say, okay, now I'm not looking at this motion because it's something that you made for a specific reason. You're scratching because, well, you're itching, for example, or you're taking a sip from your coffee that is functional, so I'm not taking it into account. So we look at a little bit of offset. We found patterns for that. We also found that it varied a little bit. So sometimes one person will be ahead, sometimes the other person will be ahead. It would always be a little bit in order of the 2-3 seconds. So I know there is a lot of debate about what is mimicry. Should it be within a second or within 5 seconds, within 10? We found most of those patterns to occur within 2-3 seconds. Yes.
I've got a question about the protocol you use for the mimicry. The interviewee could guess the situation of the interviewer. Maybe in this case, you said that the mimicry increased when the lie is a big lie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's maybe just a kind of helpful behavior from the interviewee.
Yeah, so indeed. So actually people have been looking at, can you figure out if someone's lying, not by looking at the person, but just looking at the interviewee.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that in the US, I think there was a study to figure out whether soldiers could figure out, so they would have different targets, and they would have to find out if the target was a threat or not. And then they asked people, do you think it's a threat or not? And they looked at their behavior. And if they will be asked, then they will be wrong more often than if you would be looking at their behavior. So apparently, they would unconsciously do the right thing, but then override it. It seems that the same happens with interviewees. So since the interviewees are interviewers, they're so focused on what is being said that they're not paying attention to the other person. And since mimicry works both ways, they're also copying part of the behavior of the other. So if you are having a very in-depth interview about something, also you are cognitively engaged, right? So you're trying to figure out, is he speaking the truth or not? What should I ask him? So that probably means that you're also copying more of the behavior of the other. So typically you should be able to look just at the behavior of the interviewer as well to see if certain cues show that the other person is lying or not. Was that a little bit of your question? So I think it's quite fascinating to see how this works, and we don't know exactly how it works. So mimicry is a little bit vague. We know when mimicry occurs a little bit, but we don't know exactly how it looks like. And so we don't have a nice variable that we can say, okay, this is mimicry and this is not, or this is 0.5 mimicry and this is way less. So we don't know exactly how this works. And it makes it difficult to really investigate these kind of things.
As for the lying question, I was thinking it's probably really difficult to figure out if somebody's lying or not,
mm-hmm.
because the mimicry degree I think is not correlated to the difficulty of the lie, but the degree of concentration, of focus. You might focus on what you're going to say, not making a lie or so. You might be, just because what you have to say is like a memory of long time gone, or because it's something difficult to explain or something. So that might be more relative to the degree of concentration, of focus, rather than the degree of lying. So that's one thing. I was also thinking about when you were talking about functional movements and the fact that you might mimic people in a functional way, but not in the actual movement. I was wondering if the objects you put on the people's bodies also recorded their heartbeats and the tension of the muscles, because you might have then a way to analyze mimicry in a functional way rather than in the actual movements.
Yeah.
So that was.
Yeah, so two questions, and let's start with the last one because I can remember that best. We did not record anything else but the movements with the motion capture suits. So we took some recordings, but just for the alignment and to see if anything went wrong. So heart rate, that would be a very good one. And I think there's tons of other things that we need to do. So we have been looking at bodies, other people have been looking at faces, heart rate, voice. If you would combine all of this in a multimodal approach, probably you will be able to be more certain, and also to see how complementary all these things are. So maybe I'm doing something with the body that I'm not doing with my voice, or the other way around. So that's one thing. The first question was if
people comment, if I may, or one idea.
Yeah, so for us it wasn't a problem, because we had exactly the same setup for people who were lying or not lying. Mm-hmm. So I didn't explain that clearly. So some of the people had to lie about Cluedo, others did not. So they actually played it. So it was always, we were always comparing lying to not lying. So these results are not in a presentation. And we found those differences always. So in the same situation, with the same difficulty of the topic, we would be able to say that people were lying and people were not lying. So it didn't go for everyone, but typically this was the case.
About the playground,
yes.
You have a pattern. You determine the pattern in which duration, in average, I mean.
Oh, you mean what kind of, so we would actually do this on the frame.
Okay.
Yeah, so we would smooth the tracks a little bit, because they could be a little bit noisy. But at every frame we could have a decision. So we would just be looking, what is your difference with the last frame? So it would be just tens of a second. And that would just be your speed. And also we would look at the direction just with the last frame. So it would just be at that moment.
Okay.
So it would be a little bit, if we would have tracking inaccuracies, then obviously the roles would completely change, because then if, for example, my position would be just switched back a little bit, then I would just be walking away instead of walking towards you. So it would be flaky those moments. That's why we smooth it.
Because it could be very interesting to track two hands, for instance, in sign language.
Yeah. Yeah, so and this is typically something that is really important for us as well. So we're tracking now on this just position level the children, but we don't know anything about how they really move. So if children would move backwards, then we wouldn't know. And typically the smaller the space is, the more people will use their bodies to just do all these kind of things. So even though people could tag each other just by having the circles overlap, they would still try to tag the other, but also they would try to just stop a person to do all these kind of things. So there would be a lot of body language, body movements involved that would be very interesting for us to measure, but we didn't. So again, I think if we would have more detailed level of granularity, we could get way more understanding from the play. Thanks.